And I'll start off with this thought. Children will often, or can at least, we've already found this out, tie you up in theological knots when it comes to deep questions. They ask some of the deepest questions. And when I began to think about it, I remember going about 2 years ago, I think, we were in the old rent house on Military Highway. We were putting Annabelle to bed one night, and we're reading her little rhyme Bible, the story of the Exodus, where we were at. And there was a picture of Pharaoh and Egyptians and horses and chariots drowning in the sea. They could see them like in the sea drowning. And so she says, she starts in her question with Dad, and I said, yeah, what is it? She says, well, why did God kill all these Egyptians? And I said, well, they were sinners. And she says, and you see her wheels turn. She says, well, did the horses see him? And I said, no. She said, well, why did God kill the horses? And then Challie's looking at me by this point, like, it's almost like I need to be a theological magician. How am I going to get out of this straitjacket? And so the thought came, and that I said, well, to teach us a lesson about hanging around bad people. And so I just left it at that. Talked about how bad company Kirk hunts. But recently she asked, one night we were talking, and she said, we were talking about the Lord, and she says something like, well, how do we know about God? I said, well, he came, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And he had a body just like us. He walked around just like us. Disciples knew him. They saw him. They just left beside him. And she says, but yeah, but I didn't see him. You know, how am I going to know him? I didn't see him. Why did he leave? Why didn't he stay? And I didn't have an answer until I came to John 14, verses 1 to 3. So this is my answer. This text in these three verses answers why the Lord gives his own answer, why he left, and he's not here today. John 14, 1 to 3. Do not let your heart be troubled. Believe in God and believe in me. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would have told you, for I go to prepare a place for you. If I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, so that where I am, there you may be also. So the Lord's answer falls naturally in two parts, which will make up the two parts of the message for tonight. First of all, the very first half of verse 1, he gives what we see here is the foundation for the Lord's answer to why he's leaving. Then the rest of it from 1b, if you like, or the second half of verse 1, all the way to the end of verse 3, he gives the explanation of his answer for why he's leaving. So the foundation of his answer for why he's leaving, and then the explanation. So, first of all, the foundation. He says, do not let your heart be troubled. Now, what is that? How's that a foundation? Well, just this. He mentions this first as the basis for why he even gave an explanation for why he's leaving. In other words, this is the foundational cause that even led him in his soul to even think to give him an explanation for why he's leaving. To put it another way, we would never even have an explanation for why he's leaving without this foundation. He would have never gave it. It's the reason he gave it. So the first observation then is this. The Lord, let this sink in, the Lord cares about the inward troubles of his disciples. What that means for us tonight, for those of us here who are his disciples, is the Lord cares about the troubles going on in your heart. That much we know for certain. Whatever it is, he cares. So to help you feel the glory of this, as I did, just give me a few moments to expound this word, troubled. Troubled. Can you read it there? Troubled. I think all the translations translate it that way. This English word, troubled, in the Greek is pronounced terasso. It means to shake back and forth, to stir, to be disturbed. And so if you turn back to John 5, we get a word picture of it. In John 5, in verse 7, in the story of this man we read about who was healed, who was lame, read in verse 7, the sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is terasso." Stirred. So the Lord uses a picture. This is so helpful. In other words, the soul, the human soul, according to Christ, is pictured as water that is either calm and peaceful and quiet, no movement, all is at rest, or stirred up. Emotions going back and forth like waves and tides and splashings and sloshings everywhere. One of the two. And he's saying that that is the case about the disciples. Now, when you begin to look at everywhere this word occurs, it gives you a little handle on some of the things that cause us to be troubled. In Acts 12:18, we read about these soldiers. It says there was no small disturbance amongst these soldiers because Peter had gotten free and Herod was about to kill them. So they were disturbed. It's the same word. Same in Matthew 2:3, where Herod, he heard about this king who was born and he was troubled. Same word. So it can have to do with the fear and troubling of impending death. It can have to do with false doctrine that stirs up a believer and disturbs him, shaking his assurance everywhere. So the apostles wrote in Acts 15:24 about some who have gone out from us that we did not sin, who are disturbing you by their words, unsettling your souls with what they wrote. Paul used the same thing in Galatians. Those who are trying to disturb you, trying to distort the gospel in Galatians 1:7. In 5:10 he says, the one who's disturbing you will bear his judgment. So this false teaching was disturbing. It was unsettling. They were losing their assurance. It's used about visions of ghosts and angels and spirits. And the disciples in Mark 6:50 saw Christ. It says they were terrified. Same word. And when Zechariah saw the angel standing beside him, Jeffrey Paul wasn't able to make it, but I use him in here anyway. I don't know why he wanted to pick on me today, but several times I was standing up at my desk looking at something. I look up and there he is just standing there. And the first time it didn't really, and the second time, well, I think I did like that number right there. And so Zacharias is down here handling at the altar. He turns and there's Gabriel. And it says he's troubled. It's the same word. And the disciples, when they saw Christ, and they, after he was raised, they were troubled. In John 11:33, it's used of wakes and funerals. Like Christ comes to Lazarus' tomb. He was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. It's used of betrayal and 13:21, and he says, "Now Jesus became troubled in spirit and said, 'Truly, truly, I say to you, one of you will betray me.'" There's hardly anything like it in the human experience, I think. And then a spouse cheating on a spouse, this betrayal, this digging in of the soul that some experience. Surely that's a sloshing of the sea of the emotions. Peter uses it, 1 Peter 3:14. He says, don't be intimidated by them or troubled when you're enduring persecution. So believers get troubled at that. Christ actually uses it, he says in John 12:27, "Now my soul has become troubled. What shall I say? Father, save me from this hour." So the impending wrath of God is troubled. So everywhere we see this. And so here in John 14, he uses it twice. In verse 1 and verse 27. Verse 27, he says, "Peace I leave with you, my peace give to you. Not as the world gives do I give to you. Do not let your heart be troubled, nor let it be fearful." Here's the thing to lay hold of. We talk about Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve. This was Crucifixion Eve this night. They had just gotten rebuked for missing the whole thrust of his teaching, which was love. They had just been told that one of them that they thought was the keeper of the money was going to sell him for money. And they had just been told that the forerunner spokesman for the whole group was going to deny him not once, not twice, but three times. And then they had been told over and over, "I'm going to Jerusalem, I'm going to be betrayed in the hands of the wicked, and your dream about me setting up the kingdom is going to crumble." Their hopes were crumbling. They had hoped. It said in Luke, they had hoped he would be the one. So here's what you need to lay hold of. This is what this means. You have dreams that have been or are, if you haven't, you will, that are crumbling before your very eyes. The Lord cares. We can say this. We know this. He is intimately concerned, not just with your performance, but your inward feelings. Isn't that amazing? He takes the time to deal with that. This is the foundation. He wouldn't have given an answer. This was his motive about their heart. Don't let your heart be troubled. This means he's, when you're driving to and from work on those lonely drives, considering the weight of the world and your little sea of your soul is moving, he not only sees it, he's concerned about it. He cares about it. And you lay your head down at night and everyone else from here is gone to their home and everybody's gone and you have to deal with your fears. He sees it. He's concerned about it. When you don't have a way to get away, you have to keep serving. If you're a mom or something and your kids still need you, and outwardly you're still having to do, but inwardly you're falling to pieces, he cares about every single piece that falls. Every single crumb of soul that crumbles. It's amazing. Based on that, he goes on to give his explanation in the rest of the verses that follow. So we have point two, not only the foundation for the Lord's answer of why he's leaving, but the explanation. He says in two parts. The second half of verse one is just a general statement, and then he specifically works it out in verses 2-3. The general statement is, believe in God and believe in me. So generally, what he's saying here is that our problem, their problem, and therefore our problem when it comes to being troubled, is not, how should I put this, it's not that we believe too much of reality, that we're looking too much at the problem, that we need to escape reality, go have a drink, go have a getaway, just go for
just get away, just go on vacation. That's what he said, my peace I give you, not as the world gives. We don't go the ways of the world. Escapism. The Christian position, the glory of it, is actually squarely faces reality. And so he says, no, the problem, you have grip. You do have faith in the troubles, and you see that, but you need to see them in relationship to God, in relationship to me. In other words, you need to have an aerial view, as it were, view from above, to see it all when it's proper. So your problem isn't that we need to escape from reality. We just need to see more of reality. And so, take the example of Abraham. Let me read it to you in Romans 4. You can turn to it if you want. Give you a few examples of this. In Romans 4, verse 19, we read this about Abraham's faith, which is what he's telling them to do, to have faith. It says, without becoming weak in faith. Now, what did he do? It specifically says he contemplated his own body, now as good as dead, since he was about 100 years old, and the deadness of Sarah's womb. He didn't escape from reality. He knew it. He saw it. He took note. It says he contemplated it. Okay? But he saw it in relationship to what? Verse 20, yet. So there needs to be a yet in our lives. You see what's going on? There's a trouble. And then it should be, yet, believe in God and believe in me. So Abraham, yet with respect to the promise of God, he did not waver in unbelief, but grew strong in faith, giving glory to God. And he was fully assured that what God had promised, he was able also to perform. Take the example of David. The famous story, David and Goliath. What was the situation? He was little and ruddy and handsome and unfit to go before this huge gargantuan of a man with a spear and a javelin and a sword. And he's going to him with a stick as though he's a dog to be shooed away. And remember what David said? You come to me with a javelin and a spear and a sword. I come to you in the name of the Lord. See, otherwise it made no sense to go running after the Philistine. But David had believed in all of that, but he had contemplated a wider view of reality. God. And so Jesus is telling them, don't let your heart be troubled. Look, you're responsible for this. It's like you say, look, you know, the mom leaves and tells the dad, you know, to go grocery shopping. Don't let the kids go outside today. It's cold. You talk like that when you're responsible. He says, don't let your heart be troubled. So we're responsible to keep the waters of our soul calm. Amazing thing. You remember the example of Cain. God said, if you do well, will not your countenance be lifted? You see, often we believe the lie, well, we can't really do anything about our feelings. That's not what it says. If you do well, will not it be lifted? So we're responsible to deal with them. And that's what we see here. And it's to believe. This is a general statement. And now in verse 2 and 3, he works it out specifically. So what are they to believe about God? This, that in my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, would have told you, now boy, are there some people that have got this thing wrong. I grew up singing this song. I can't remember this whole song, but some of y'all grew up in church. You remember about a big, big house with lots and lots of room. And just, it would say like, this is my Father's house. Big, big yard. We can play football. All this. Well, that is surely not. Well, it's not a protrusion of some earthly, worldly thing maximalized. We're not Muslims, okay? So we don't just maximize earthly pleasures and say that's what heaven is. So what does he mean?
Well, we need to let John tell us what he means. So turn back to chapter 2. He's already told us. And in case we've forgotten, the very beginning of this gospel in John 2:13, we read this. The Passover of the Jews was near, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And he found in the temple those who were selling oxen and sheep and doves and the money changers seated at their tables. And he made a scourge of cords. He drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen, and he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And to those who were selling the doves, he said, take these things away. Stop making my Father's house a place of business. His disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. So when I read in John 14, in my Father's house, I'm thinking temple. I'm thinking the new temple, the true, real temple, dwelling place of God. Now, how can it refer? Some people will ask this, well, how can it refer? Surely this is not talking about that, the temple, because literal temples don't really have many dwelling places, right? Well, the problem is he's not talking about some little small literal temple. So let me show you one of the most glorious things in all of Scripture. Take one spot and go to 1 Kings 6, verse 20. And this is one of the things that if you mark anything in Scripture, you want to mark these two passages. 1 Kings 6:20. And when Solomon is building the temple, we read this in chapter 6, verse 20. The inner sanctuary was 20 cubits in length, 20 cubits in width, and 20 cubits in height. And he overlaid it with gold. So it was a cube. Everybody see that? 20 one way, 20 that way, 20 this way. Perfect cube overlaid with gold. Now turn to Revelation chapter 21. In verse 15. See if you can notice this. The one who spoke with me had a gold measuring rod to measure the city and its gates and its walls. Now, just to set the context, at the turn of 21, John has described the new creation as a new creation and a city and a temple. And so he's talking about one reality, and it's just got different descriptions, all these different pictures, ways of thinking about it. So it's a new heaven and a new earth. It's the temple of God dwelling among men. It's a city coming down out of heaven. After saying it had a gold measuring rod to measure it, we pick back up in verse 16. The city is laid out as a square, and its length is as great as the width. And he measured the city with the rod 1,500 miles, its length and width and height are equal. Here's the connection between these two verses. And all good commentators of Revelation think so. John's not describing a literal temple. And just to make it this overarching point that there's no time in this sermon to defend, but people think there's going to be a future literal temple based on Ezekiel. But John in Revelation, right here, is echoing Ezekiel everywhere. So what we know is his apostolic interpretation of Ezekiel is this temple. And what he's saying is this, just as Solomon
in that Holy of Holies, that inner sanctuary, that was a perfect cube. So this city is a perfect cube. Point, punchline, the entire creation is the temple of God. That's why there's no need for any moonlight, anything. He's the light. And Israel's temple was always kind of like, think of it like this. You know how architects, before they go to make something, they make a little model. And it's got the trees and the shrubs and the little building and everything. This is how it's going to be. But it's not the reality. It's just a little model. That's what the temple was. A little model of the heavens and the earth. And what was to happen. That light coming off of those lampstands was like, the little kids sometimes have these toys. We have one where it's like puts the stars everywhere. That's what that was. That was to illustrate heaven, this inner veil over here. All of it had meaning, and it was the hope that the glory that was in that Holy of Holies would one day fill the whole earth as the waters cover the seas. And John is saying at the end of the Bible that's why Solomon, he carved palm branches, leaves, pomegranates, all on the inner walls of the temple. You see, it's mixed with Eden-like images and structures, and so the whole hope of the temple was new creation. So when Jesus says, in my Father's house are many dwelling places, the reason he could say that is he's not talking about a literal temple. In the renewed new heavens and new earth, there will be many dwelling places. There's room for everyone who comes, all who come to me. I'll in no wise cast out. There's a verse in Zechariah, one of my favorites. It says, the streets of the city will be filled with children playing in the streets. And that's what he's saying. Don't let your heart be troubled. In this place that's coming, there are many dwelling places. An amazing thing. And so, what are they to believe concerning Christ? That's what they're to believe concerning the Father. That He has a coming new creation temple that has many dwelling places. Well, concerning Christ, remember He says, not just believe in God, but believe in Me. Here's what they're to believe about Him. First of all, if it were not so, I would have told you. I love this. If you had anything to be fearful about, I would have told you. So if you can't think of anything to be fearful about, you don't need to try to think about anything to be fearful about. Right? Isn't that how a good dad is with his child? You know, they're walking. He said, look. Chill out. If there was something going to bother Phil, I would let you know. You know, avoid this, dude. He says, I would have told you. Chill out. Basically, it's really an amazing phrase. I've always just kind of skimmed over it, you know. So this is what he says. I go. That's the problem. That's causing all the trouble. That's what Annabelle was wondering about, the I go piece. Well, I thought you were going to stay. We could all see. He says, I go. And then he says, to prepare a place for you. That's why he's going. He's explaining why he's leaving. And again, people have gone wrong here. Because they've already gone wrong with the Father's house. And they think that the Lord is going to do some carpentry work or something, you know. Heaven was not quite, some of the rooms were run down and he did some renovations. And basically for 2,000 years he's been nailing boards and squaring and doing measurements. And when he's done, he'll come get us all and it'll be ready. And it's preposterous. Now that you already know he's talking about the temple, what he means when he says, I'm leaving to prepare a place, you could get a better image like this, since we're talking about the temple. Imagine if Moses, in his day, Solomon in his day, the temple, had gone out and told the Israelites, look, in the Holy of Holies are many dwelling places. Let's go. They would have said, and you die for going in there. Or imagine on the mountain, he said, look, brothers, many dwelling places on the mountain. They would have said, yeah. And the ox can't even touch it or else he dies. What he's saying is, in this temple are many dwelling places, and I'm going to prepare a place for you. I'm going to do what it takes so that you can enter the presence of God safely. He's referring to the cross and the resurrection and the ascension, where the book of Hebrews says he opens up a living way. So basically, in his leaving then, he's leaving in order to be tearing down the veil.
Yeah.
And the moment he dies, it happens. And you know what I see in that? I have based many gloomy nights on this. I put my weight on this. I live by this. The worst evil to ever happen was his death. He was the most precious person to ever live. Therefore, to mistreat him is the greatest sin ever committed. And at the point in history where the greatest sin was being committed, the greatest good for men occurred. The veil came torn down right in the middle. And so I reason from that, I say, if God can bring that much good out of the worst, heinous sin ever experienced, what can he do in my life? Can't he bring good out of this situation that I'm in? He says, look, don't let your heart be troubled. Believe. Don't you believe the gospel? Don't you believe that when I left, I tore the temple? Don't you believe that the sin of crucifying me was the worst in history? Don't you believe that the greatest good occurred at that moment? Believe in me. I go, and that's what he means by prepare a place. And so he says, using simple logic, if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again. That's the second coming. And receive you to myself. Literally take you to my side. So if you've ever prepared like a surprise party for someone and everybody's ready and everything's set and someone goes out to get them and you walk them in with them, he says, I will take you to my side where I am. You may be also. As this is ludicrous. Would Solomon get all the cedars of Lebanon and all this big grass, slaves and armory and build this big temple? And when he got through, what did he do? He put in the items. It would be irrational to build this thing. He's saying, as certain as I went. Don't we forget this, though. He's coming back. As certain as he went, he's coming back to take us with him, that we may, and isn't that the blessed hope? Paul says, you want comfort. Comfort one another with these words, so we shall always be with the Lord. That's the comfort. And he says, I'm going to come, receive you to myself, so that where I am, you may be also. So here's the full picture in conclusion. Sometimes dads have to leave, go to work, have to leave to go on business or something, take care of some matters. And it's not uncommon at certain times in a child's life, like, Dad, but I want you to stay. Why do you have to leave? And I want you to play and stay. Why do you have to leave and go? And it's not uncommon to dads say, look, if it were, you can trust me, if it were not important, I would not be leaving. And I'm going to work so that I can make money and bring it home and take care of y'all. And that, in a sense, is all he's saying. Don't let your heart be troubled. and I'm leaving? If it were not for your good, I would not be leaving. I'm going to open up. I must die for this great thing and blessing to come to you. I must raise from the dead. I must cut through that heavenly temple and sit at the right hand of God and wait for the last Gentile and Jew to be converted. And so, if any of us disciples here tonight are feeling like the Lord has left you in some situation, you don't even feel like He's there. This text says, I would never leave you. You would never even feel that I left you if it were not for your good. Do not let your heart be troubled. And if anybody's wondering, why is He not here? This is why He's not here. He had to die. He had to be raised. He had to ascend. So let me read the text. Hear the words of your Lord one more time. Do not let your heart be troubled. Believe in God and believe in me. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. If I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, so that where I am, you may be also. Well, why don't we close in prayer? And I think I'll ask Mom to pray.
Thank you, Lord. Just thank you so much for this truth.